We're talking with Bob Spitz, whose book, The Beatles, is considered to be the definitive book about the most important band and most successful band in history. As we were mentioning about where the song ideas come from, at least one of these songs that Bob talks about in the book just came in a dream while Paul McCartney was sleeping, just popped into his head. Going to hear that story when we come back. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. Bob, I mentioned that we were talking about the inspiration for the songs that they cranked out, and at least one instance you detail it in the book about Paul McCartney having a dream and waking up and this thing was in his head, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it happened, George. He had just moved to London. He was, talk about good luck, living in the house owned by his girlfriend's parents. He had his own room at the top of the house. With a piano in it. And one morning he woke up and there was a song in his head. I mean, he knew it wasn't his original composition because how could anybody wake up with an entire song in his head? So he kind of cribbed it out on the piano. He went around the corner to the house of a guy named Lionel Bart. Lionel was had written a lot of rock and roll songs, but he also had the show Oliver on stage at the time, and he had written all the music for it. And Lionel Bart really knew music from one end to the other. And Paul played him the song and said, "Lionel, tell me, who did I steal this from? Whose song is it?" And he said, "No, Paul, that's yours, man. That's original, as original as I've ever heard. And it was the song Yesterday. I mean, it was all there. It came to him in a dream." Talk about your subconscious working for you, huh?
Yeah, that's the most recorded song in history, I guess.
It is, without a doubt, yeah. So, I've been going to sleep ever since I got that little piece of information. I've been going to sleep trying to come up with something for myself.
You mentioned in the book about something he had the word scrambled eggs in his mind when in the terms where the word yesterday would go?
Well, yeah, it wasn't that he had it in his mind. He couldn't come up with words for the song. I mean, he didn't come up with the words yesterday until almost a year later, but the song haunted him. It was one of the hardest compositions he ever really had to put lyrics to. He couldn't figure it out for the life of him. Everything sounded wrong. So for the longest time, he just used the word scrambled eggs instead of yesterday. And that was the title of the song for a while. He had this fantastic melody, and he just couldn't crack it. He couldn't put the right words to it. And finally, it came to him while he was on vacation in Portugal with his girlfriend. He was in a car, and he just started to write, and it all came pouring out right there in the car. That's the way songs came to these guys in those days, George. They came fast and furiously, and they don't know where they came from. You know, the same thing happened with Bob Dylan. I wrote his biography as well. And in Dylan's early days, people told me that, you know, they would walk uptown with Dylan from the Greenwich Village uptown. It took them about a half hour. And by the time they got uptown, song just poured out of Dylan. He kept pulling pieces of paper out of his pocket, writing things down because it just was trying to get out of him. I mean, and I saw it with Bruce Springsteen in his early days. So that's the way things evolved.
You know, it's probably presumptuous of the early Beatles to need a manager. But as talented as they were, it turns out they did meet a manager. And the guy who became their manager would seem to be, I don't know, he wouldn't be the first choice, I guess. It wouldn't seem like a likely choice.
No. Brian Epstein was, he was an anomaly in Liverpool. He was a fuss, budgety little guy. He always dressed in a suit. He spoke the Queen's English. He was very proper, so unlike the Beatles. You know, they always thought of him when they were kids. They thought of Brian as this older gentleman, but he was really only 4 years older than they were. He ran the record store that in his father's appliance shop. And Brian wasn't interested in rock and roll at all. He was he loved classical music. He loved opera. But somebody took him to see the Beatles at the Cavern because he had heard that they were an up-and-coming band. He wanted to see what it was all about. And it really shook him. Whatever he saw in that club shook him up completely. Just completely turned his life upside down. and he approached them to become their manager. You said the Beatles might not have needed a manager. Oh, they did. They really did. They may have been responsible when it came to getting to the gigs and everything, but their lives were kind of a mess, and Brian pulled everything together for him. He was the right man at the right time, and while he was alive, he really saw to it that the legacy that they were building was intact and growing all the time. He really spearheaded the whole thing.
He really drove them, as you note in the book. I mean, booking them all over the place, even though they're dead tired, he'd book them for this and book them for that and really kept it going. He also made a heck of a lot of mistakes that you detail in the book in later years that cost them millions of dollars.
Multi-millions of dollars. I mean, in the 20 millions, in the 30 millions, Brian gave their merchandising away. But that's some guy who said, hey, I think the Beatles have some merchandising here. Can I handle it? And Brian said, sure. He didn't even know this guy. The guy was kind of a hustler. And the guy thought that he would get a 90-10 deal from Brian, where he would get 10% and Brian would get 90%. But when he laid it out, he said, I'm looking for a 90-10 deal. Brian gave him 90% and 10% for the Beatles. And this guy did everything. He licensed everything, Beatles wigs, Beatles shampoo, Beatles wallpaper, Beatles instruments. The Beatles saw none of that money. Beatles T-shirts, nothing. It all went 90-10 to this guy. And Brian also made a very bad recording deal for the Beatles, even though he did make their deal for them when nobody wanted to put them on record. Brian made a deal that haunted them for years. When they were selling millions upon millions of albums for EMI, they were still getting only, like a half penny a record. Really dismal compared to what they should have been getting.
A lot of labels in Britain and the United States took a pass on them, just didn't see anything extraordinary.
Every label. They got turned down by everyone.
And even George Martin, you tell the story in the book, George Martin didn't see it immediately either.
No, they came in and they did an audition. And in fact, there were two auditions that day. It was the Beatles and a group called Brian Poole and the Tremolos, which later became the Tremolos, and they had many hits. But they got turned at, they took the Tremolos, they didn't take the Beatles. George Martin didn't hear it as well. He thought that the Beatles were, their music was kind of disjointed. But what he did like was he thought that they had some kind of a spark that he couldn't put his finger on. And it had as much to do with their personality and their sense of humor as much as it did with music. And so he thought, I'll give these guys a chance. And the minute he got in the studio with them, he saw that there was much more to these guys than he had anticipated. And he started to mold them into really recording sensations.
Let's talk about Beatlemania a little bit. Eventually, of course, they caught on in Britain and then later in the United States. And you have a lot of details about what life was like for them. If you weren't alive back then, it's hard to even imagine. You can see some newsreel footage of audiences going crazy. But what their life became was like a living hell.
Well, they became prisoners of their own lives, George. They, they loved the attention and they loved the fans and they loved performing. But first of all, it eventually became came to the point where they couldn't leave a hotel. They had to run for their lives after a performance. They had a car waiting outside with all the doors open, and they literally had to run from the backstage toward the car, dive into the car as the car was in motion, pulling away, and they pulled the doors shut so they could get out of there before the girls got their hands on them. So, performing started to become a nightmare for them and really became more of a nightmare when the kids started screaming so much from the time they hit the stage to the time they left the stage that the Beatles couldn't even hear what they were playing. There were no monitors in those days, so they couldn't hear the sound that they were making. It all came from the tiny little amps behind them. And the kids screaming drowned that out. So often the Beatles couldn't hear each other. And there were times that they went on stage and they just faked it. They didn't even play. They didn't strum or play. They strummed, but they, you know, they weren't singing with each other because nobody could hear them anyway. And that really, that upset them. They were real players. They loved the craft of making music, of performing. And it so they became prisoners of that as well. And it became a nightmare for them after a while.
I mean, they stopped touring basically as it wasn't fun because nobody could hear them anyway, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they stopped touring, you're right, because of that. But also because they were starting to make music that they couldn't duplicate on stage. Once they started to crank out albums like Rubber Soul and Revolver, they realized that they were doing such unique things in the studios that it would be very hard to duplicate on stage.
Like what kind of things were they doing that that nobody else was doing? That's an amazing part of the book, is your description of these guys from Liverpool who, you know, learned sort of on-the-job training their instruments and then became masters in the studio.
Well, yes. You know, in the early days, George, rock and roll bands were really like little children in the studios. They were told, you come in for 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon. You were not allowed to touch anything except your instruments. You can't come into the control room. You play your songs, and you get out, and you have to do it in that amount of time. And that was the rule of thumb for every rock and roll band in those days, whether you were in America or in Great Britain. But the Beatles weren't satisfied with that. They wanted to create their own sound. And so they started to experiment. They experimented with different instruments and different tape effects. And George Martin was such an innovator, and he recognized that the boys were such innovators as well, the boys meaning the Beatles, that he gave them their heads in the studio. He allowed them to experiment. He let them come into the control room. He let them go into Abbey Road's closet, where all unique instruments were kept. And the Beatles dragged them out. They came into the studio with them. They experimented with different sounds. And they really created in the studio, which no rock and roll band was ever allowed to do before. And that changed everything. It changed everything for all the rock and roll groups that followed, and it changed the sound of music as well.
Back to the Beatlemania part of it, because a lot of the details I had never heard before. I can just sort of barely remember it as a kid, the screaming crowds and everything. But I, to this day, I don't really understand what was going on there. Maybe you have some theories. The spasms, the craziness that swept over the crowds, the hysterics of it are hard to explain.
Well, you know, all these kids, their own lives were being unlocked. Look, in those days, in the early 60s, the 50s and the 60s especially, teenagers were really an appendage of the family. They had no real identity. They were told how to behave. They were disciplined in school and didn't really have a sense of, you know, the teenagers that we now know today. And it all came undone. It was like their whole lives were unlocked. They heard this music. It created some frenzy inside of them, and they went nuts on stage. And that was really the beginning of teenagers as a major force in our culture today. It all came out in those Beatles shows. And then afterwards, of course, and, you know, with the Dave Clark Five and the Hollies and the Stones and all those bands. And teenagers took over our culture. But it all came at the sound of rock and roll. The rock and roll unlocked all of that.
Well, it's still almost the case. You look at movies and TV, the demographics that the movie studios and the publishers and producers all go for are the teenagers still.
Yeah, well, that all came from the Beatles. There was no teenage market before the Beatles. I mean, there was rock and roll. You know, there was Elvis and Buddy Holly. But aside from those 45 records, nobody catered to the Beatles in any other part. And nobody catered to teenagers, in any other part of the culture. It all came about because of the Beatles. And they created that teenage market for everything, for clothing, for, you know, lifestyle. lifestyle for the works.
Some of the other things that changed. I mean, kids in those days would buy singles, and after the Beatles, they bought albums.
Yes, exactly right. That was another phenomenon that came from the Beatles. First, actually, it started with something called EPs. I don't know if any of your listeners are old enough to remember EPs, but after the Beatles put out, you know, four or five songs, then an EP would come out, and it would have maybe three songs on one side, two songs on the other, and it would be in the form of a 45, but it was kind of like a mini album that you would buy, and it had a front and back cover, and not like a 45 sleeve. And then from that, it jumped right into albums, and kids had to have the album. You know, the Beatles created demand. And so kids weren't satisfied with just hearing the latest single. In those days, you know, a new band would put out a single every 6 months, maybe, but they wanted it all at once, like binge TV watching today. And so the album became a major force. And once the Beatles started to make albums, all rock and roll groups started to make albums.
I can't imagine what the value of their holdings or their entire enterprise would be these days. You know, you look at it in 2014 dollars. I mean, despite the bad decisions made by their manager, gosh, they made a heck of a lot of money, but what it would be today is unimaginable.
Well, I think it's astronomical. You had mentioned earlier that they sold 600 million albums, but they continue to sell millions of albums even today, 50 years later. So, their income it balloons by the moment. It's like that crock for the national debt. That's the Beatles' fortune right there.
Do you smile at yourself when you hear people arguing about whether they're a Paul person or a John person, the idea that you have to pick a camp to be faithful to?
Yeah, well, I'm smiling right now, George. I mean, yeah, exactly. You know, it's everybody kind of has to choose their favorite people, but it really kind of boils down to Paul and John. And the reason it does is because they each had brought something different, as I said before, to the Beatles, and they each kind of have a different kind of image. John, that tough, you know, tough, raw guy, and Paul, the smooth, doe-eyed guy, you know, with a big smile. It's like arguing whether you think it's the Beatles or the Stones. It's the same kind of argument.
You have any kind of informed speculation about what could have been had John Lennon and George Harrison lived, whether or not they would ever got back together in some kind of capacity?
I have more than speculation for you. I can tell you without a doubt they never, ever would have gotten back together again. I've talked to Paul about it, and I know from what I know about John as well. When the Beatles broke up, they might have broken up because they weren't getting along, but they knew what they had created. They had a brand and a legacy that they were very conscious of, and they were never going to let that become diluted. And because of that, they never wanted to be dragged into some sentimental reunion. Never. It never would have happened. They were offered umpteen millions of dollars to get back together again, and they turned those down. They even turned down some offers for a $20 million performance to be given to charity. They wouldn't even do it for charity. They were not going to dilute that image. And I think that you would ask me at the top of the show, you know, why we still listen to the Beatles today. And that's one of the big factors, that they didn't prostitute the Beatles' name. I don't think they ever would have gotten back together again.
You know, there were problems with it even being offered digitally, their music. There was disputes. I think it's just in the last couple of years that a lot of this stuff was even available on iTunes, and to the frustration of their fans. I don't know if that's part of this.
It is part of the same thing. They wanted everything to be perfect. They didn't want it slapped together. And again, it was part of protecting that image. I think it was also a very clever tool, a merchandising tool, by holding back from putting the Beatles on iTunes, they were creating a demand.
We'll talk more about that and open up the phone lines for your questions for Bob Spitz. Everybody has their favorite Beatles song, of course. If you were to take a poll of music critics, chances are that song, A Day in the Life, might rank up there as their masterpiece, their masterwork from Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. We'll ask my guest, Bob Spitz, how that song was written, the story behind it, and then open up the phone lines with some of your calls right after this on Coast to Coast. In his book, The Beatles, the biography, Bob Spitz details a little bit about how the song A Day in the Life was written. Bob, you want to tell the story?
Yeah, well, John had read the newspaper article in which somebody had lost their lives in a car accident. And he actually knew the people involved. It was somebody involved with the Guinness beer company, and sat down at the piano and just rolled it out. But recording that song was incredibly difficult. It took the Beatles months to get down in the studio, and it was an effort for not just all of them, but George Martin as well, and took really months on end.
That piano note at the end, too, that was difficult for him to create.
Five hands on five different pianos, one chord, and they had to do it at the split second. And not only that, but without, you know, overtaxing the reverberation on all the microphones and the music console. But, you know, it just went with all the Beatles' luck. They did it once, and that was the take. These guys really had luck on their side, as well as all that creative talent.
You know, we saw Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr on television last month. Both of them have been here in Las Vegas and performing to rave reviews in the last couple of months. The Rolling Stones were here not that long ago, maybe the best concert I've ever heard them give. What's the deal with this generation? You know, when our parents were this age, they were retired or and sitting in their rocking chairs. It's like this generation doesn't want to get old.
No, and I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, with the music, too. The music keeps you young. It keeps your spirits alive, and it unlocks a lot of memories that won't go away, a lot of good memories, and carries you on. But these guys have, you know, they've been out. They've never stopped performing. They are real masters of the craft. And more than anything, I think what really captured your imagination, George, when you saw them, is that they love to perform. And that comes out when you see them. So, you know, I don't think they're ever going to stop, any of them.
Your newest book about the British invasion, based a lot on the biography.
Yes, it really came about to commemorate the 50th anniversary of their first appearance in the United States, and that happened, of course, when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964. It was a monumental event here in the States. And it kind of transformed teenagers all over the country. Everybody had tuned into it, you know, 74 million people. It was the largest television audience of the kind. I was a 13-year-old kid at the time who saw them that night. And everything changed after it. So we tried to capture it in a short book that Time Life put out, and it's called The Beatles Invasion.
Well, I hope people will check that out. Actually, I hope they'll check out the larger book, the biography, because it's just a wonderful project and a wonderful job by you. We're going to open up the phone lines. First-time caller, Patrick in Santa Barbara. Good morning, Patrick.
Listener, George, first-time caller, I really appreciate your show. You're the best talk show since Art Bell. And thank you, Bob. What a pleasure to hear these wonderful stories on a Saturday night here. And I appreciate that, Bob. Do you cover in your book the meeting between Elvis and the Beatles? Because the story I have is that they were waiting down there, you know, on the couch or whatever. Elvis walks down the stairs, and they're so in awe, they don't even say anything. And Elvis turns around and says, well, if you guys aren't going to talk to me, I'm going to go back to bed. You know? And where did that take place, the meeting between Elvis and the Beatles? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, Patrick, thank you. It took place in L.A., of all places. The Beatles were there to perform, and they always wanted to meet Elvis. You know, Elvis was kind of their hero. I think it was Heartbreak Hotel that really made John a rock and roll fan. So this was a monumental meeting. It was really staged so that, you know, the king could meet the kings. And I think that when it happened, both of them got so shy that they couldn't really talk to each other. They were in this room. The Beatles, you know, were just cracking jokes about Elvis because they were in awe of him. They were so uncomfortable. Elvis was there with his buddies, all the guys that he traveled with, and they were playing pool and they were doing their own thing. And finally, Elvis just said, "Hey, listen, if you guys aren't going to play music, then I'm going to bed." At which point, the guitars came out and they started to mix it up, and that was quite an evening of music.
Thanks for the call, Patrick. East of the Rockies, John in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on with Bob Spitz.
Good morning. I really love the show and really enjoy listening to your program. And I've studied the Beatles a lot. I actually interviewed George's sister for a project I've been working on. But I got a couple comments, and then I think I have an answer to your question where you said it all came from. There was an interesting story I had read once that you said about being ruthless, when they were touring with Roy Orbison, maybe even half kiddingly, but they supposedly held him back from taking an encore. That's pretty competitive, I would think. But the other thing is, I think from what I've read and never studied is that John did have a chip on his shoulder from losing his mother and the father and everything. And if you ever read, you know, they always have that big blow up about his statement about Jesus, but very little was ever read. You know, I looked it up and read the entire interview where he was coming from. You read the whole interview. And for like Paul got that song to In a Dream and put them words to it, because when you get a dream, you don't remember the rhythm too much. So he came up with filler words real quick. And then he went around, couldn't believe he wrote that song. Well, all that song is a very simple and a complex song at the same time. That's why it's been recorded by more artists in the Guinness Book of World Records. But, you know, I think it's a problem when you're out in the world and you've seen everything like that. It's hard to be humble. How do you be humble when you're a Beatle? And the thing of it is anyone would say he's gifted. They're very gifted. Well, if you're gifted, that means you've been given a gift. And I think there's a tragedy involved in their lives that, you know, for one thing, Paul doesn't give credit. Any artist I've ever read of the great artist of the history and everything has always been considered, they knew where their talent originally came from God. And I've never heard that acknowledged by him.
John, we're going to let Bob get in on this. You have a pretty good section about the Jesus remark.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, John really felt that he was misquoted. He was just making the statement that he felt that the Beatles' popularity had gotten out of hand, and that some people felt that they were, you know, that, you know, in a way that he felt they were bigger than Jesus. And in a way, John was really saying we shouldn't be. You know, that's not the way it should be, that, you know, religion should come first. There was a sense of irony involved with what he was saying, but the media pulled it way out of context with And it was the first time, I think, in the Beatles' history that John really came unglued. He had to make a statement to the press, you know, refuting everything that they were painting him with this particular statement. And it took place at the Old Americana Hotel in New York City. And before he met the press, John really, he came apart. He didn't know how to talk to them. He got upset. He started to cry. And it really affected him very deeply. I think he had never been taken out of context like that before and created such a furor. And it upset him. But I think that's what did happen. And also to answer John, the Beatles weren't really religious guys. They never became religious guys. But they were very, very spiritual, and I think they were all in touch with some inner force, and they recognized that, and they worked towards that all throughout their careers.
You know, we've also, Bob, you and I have been talking here this for the last 2 hours about the rivalry between McCartney and Lennon, but they were also, there was a great friendship. These guys loved each other. And although there was bickering, as in any family, when they were threatened from outside, they hung together, such as during that whole Jesus furor.
You bet, George. You hit it right on the head. These guys really did love each other, and often they didn't understand that love. They couldn't really express it. But even at the end, when they were fighting and supposedly not talking to each other because they were suing each other and trying to sort out all their business arrangements, when anybody threatened them from the outside, it was all for one and one for all. They came together. Whenever anybody threatened them legally or any way, they hung together. One of the really interesting things about the Beatles is that when they traveled, you know, these guys were multimillionaires. When they traveled as a group, they never stayed in different hotel rooms. They'd take a suite, and they'd all stay together in one suite. When they went on vacations with their wives or girlfriends, they went together. They went with other guys, with other members of the band. So while, you know, they had all the conflicts that a family has, they still couldn't be without that family, even to the very end.
Go to the wild card line, Joe in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning, Joe. You're on with Bob Spitz.
God bless and namaste light to you and to Mr. Wells and Mr. Norrie. I adored this show from its inception, and Art Bell as well. I had the occasion to meet someone from the Hit Factory in New York City after John's untimely death. And Yoko went into the recording studio, to make Season of Glass. And I have a very quick story, and I want you to confirm or relate if you're aware of this. John, first of all, referred to Yoko as Mother. That was his nickname for Yoko Ono. And I guess she was definitely a mother figure in his life, and he lost his mother at a young age. Well, this was after John had passed. Yoko's in the studio with just one gentleman who I've met in our area where I live in Chapel Hill. And he said over the sound system at a quiet moment during the recording session, John's voice came across the amplification system and said, Mother, referring to Yoko, Mother, I love you and I always miss you on Mother's Day. And it was Mother's Day. Have you ever heard of this story?
I wish I could confirm that for you, Joe, but I've never heard that story before. That may be apocryphal, but Yoko was definitely a mother image to him, without a doubt. I think he needed that role in his life desperately. People always blame Yoko for breaking up the Beatles, but I think it was Yoko who really saved John Lennon's life. You know, he was careening towards disaster in his life, and Yoko gave him someone to really, really love and look up to and respect and transform his life. And even though she did take him away from the Beatles, she got him back on his feet again, and really he found someone to love. So while I can't confirm your story, I can tell you that Yoko's part in the John Lennon biography is a very, very important and a valuable one.
Thanks, Joe. Steve in Monterey, California. Hi, Steve. You're on with Bob.
I appreciate the opportunity. Say, Yoko, we all didn't like her to begin with. And I was always against people for that. But it turns out there was no trial for John Lennon's killer. Shame on the American people for that. You have to read LennonMurderTruth.com to understand the nightmare John Lennon's death represents. LennonMurderTruth.com.
Okay. Well, did you want to say something to Bob?
Well, I want to say that Nixon and Reagan let Stephen King kill John Lennon, and that's why there was no trial for his killer.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. Okay. You have any thoughts on John Lennon's murder, Bob? I guess I remember that day, man. That was a sad day. It's still a sad day.
Yeah, it was one of the most senseless murders in the annals of history. I can only tell you that the next morning, in New York City, I had to walk to work, and you could walk 25 blocks in Manhattan and no one talked, no one looked up, no one blew car horns. The entire city was in mourning. Something shook people from the very foundations of their soul when John died. People got a sense of how senseless that murder was, and they took it personally. And I think people never stopped taking that personally. So, it was a horrible day.
There's a little place, as you know, in Central Park in New York City. I guess is it called Strawberry Fields, right across from the Dakota?
It is, and they renamed that part of the park in honor of John. It was a place that he and Yoko often walked. It was across from their apartment, as you said. And it had become a major tourist attraction in New York City now. People kind of make the pilgrimage the same way that they make the pilgrimage to the zebra stripe outside Abbey Road on the street where they filmed the photograph for the Abbey Road cover. Yeah, it's a big pilgrimage here.
You ever speculate on what else could have been? I know you said that they couldn't have gotten back together, but not for any tour or anything or a show. But they all made such great music, continue to make such great music. You look back at the creative output, the collective creative output. It's just astonishing.
Well, you know, George, I think we got all we were going to get from the Beatles. I think, you know, it came out of them. They poured out those 184 songs. And it's like a canon almost, like, Beethoven's symphonies or Shakespeare's plays. This is what we were going to get from the Beatles. I don't think they had anything left to give us. And, people always mourn the fact that the Beatles broke up. But I think it was a key time for them to leave, to come apart. And that's why we remember the music today, that it was so powerful and so compact and it affected all of us so greatly, but that's all there was.
Anything else you're working on you want to talk about? I can't imagine you'd want to tackle a project of this magnitude again.
Well, you know, I'm such a sucker for these things. After I wrote the Beatles biography, I spent 4 years as Julia Child's biographer. But now I've taken on an even bigger job. I am Ronald Reagan's biographer. And, where the Beatles took about 8 years, I am already 4 years into this project. And I won't even start writing for another couple of years. I'm still researching, and it's a really long, complicated, fascinating story.
Well, in about 4 years from now, when you write this thing, you'll have to come back and see us.
You can count on it.
Bob Spitz, thanks very much. I do encourage people to check. I'd really appreciate you joining us. It was fascinating.
My pleasure, George.
I do encourage folks to check out this book. It's called The Beatles, The Biography. It was a national bestseller when it first came out, and it's an engrossing book. You're hooked from the very beginning, and as well as the new book that he's got out, the Time Life book about the British invasion. Very entertaining. I want to thank my earlier guests, not only Bob Hoover, but Richard Hoover, and then all my friends there at Coast to Coast for putting on this program. I'll be back tomorrow night. We're going to talk about cattle mutilations with Chris O'Brien, and I hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.